Vitruvian Boy, a novel in 25 chapters by Andrew Bone. Chapter 1. The House That Ate Time. Everybody knew the house was haunted, but just like with UFOs and economic miracles, just as many everybodies were afraid to admit they believed it. Obviously nobody lived, was not yet dead, there. Never had done, so had never had visitors of any type. This was hardly surprising, since the gates were rusted shut. On closer inspection, also welded shut, bolted, locked 7 times in 7 entirely different and creative ways, and finally sewed up with some discouraging species of ivy. And for good measure, an ancient condemned notice swung by 1 surviving pure rust bolt, only staying intact by virtue of the mysterious forces inherent in chemical lethargy. Not that the building was ugly or anything like that. It was well kept, though nobody kept it, and beautiful, since its age meant no architect had applied theories to it. All around the large ornate property was a metal, nasty, spiky fence, where it could be said the strangeness of the whole edifice began. On the street side, the metal railings of this fence were bloated with rust, which fell like cappuccino topping to the pavement. But on the inside, the railings were as if new, shiny and strong, and, you would swear, renewing itself. The metal succeeded in convincing you it was alive. Unlike most people, Sean Silpierre was not afraid of the haunted house. He had spent all his 12 years living in the large villa next door, so to him it was just part of the backdrop to larger life he encountered whenever he drew back his curtains. He therefore hardly notched above curious when one day a group of experts from some university or other had come to test this miracle ghost metal of the fence railings. Without daring to enter the property, they probed through the rust from the outside, trying to reach the shiny metal on the inside. After a middling long while, they swore, first individually, then after one last hard probe in unison, as they suddenly dropped their tools and dignity and ran away. No technical paper, no report, no research grant were forthcoming, and, as Sean noted, no more experts ever came. The local town council decided one day to demolish the building so they could build an empty lot. And even though it was one of the oldest buildings in Lugano, Renaissance era, and in perfect condition, nobody organized demonstrations or Save Our Heritage protests. They didn't have to. On the ordained day, the now famous bulldozer raced at the speed of cynicism towards the fence. It managed to make a hole, and had even begun to pass through the gap, but as soon as its engine and driver's cabin entered the grounds, the machine stopped. Now I ask you, what does it take to kill a 15-ton bulldozer dead in its tracks? The evolving legend has it that the driver had been stolen by the demons that infest the house. Cooler heads admitted that he must have been truly spooked, for when all the dust and panic had subsided, he had to be taken to hospital, and the poor man has been absent without leave ever since. What they were forced to agree on was that the bulldozer stopped because its front half had, well, aged suddenly, by the look of the corrosion, by some hundreds of years. The beast still stands there today, its bright yellow rear projecting back into the street, like some sort of giant ferreting rubber duck, while its front half inside the property has rusted to pieces, with guillotine-like precision up to the fence line, its tires ugly splotches of fatigue. In terms of rights, by poetic assertion, it formed a far more potent deterrent to illegal entry than any number of signs and locks. Birds. Ravens make the best telling, but once known to be seen alighting on the roof of the haunted house, but were supposedly never seen to leave. Sooner or later they got the message too. There was one baby raven which Sean had found as a chick, fallen from the tree that had had the effrontery to toy with overhanging the garden of the haunted house. Its parents had vanished. Sean raised the fledgling, feeding it worms he caught himself, and named it Baldric. One sad day, Baldric disappeared too. The house had an omnivorous appetite. And Baldric was not the only pet to be affected by the house. One day, our 12-year-old Sean Solpierre remembers seeing Mrs. Irwin, the cook's cat, whose name is Srodi, fleeing from a dog by the root of the haunted house. When she jumped through the fence, Sean swears he saw her disappear in mid-flight. So does the dog, who has been a nervous wreck and has lived on a feline-free diet ever since. Don't worry, Srodi is still with us, sort of, anyway, as much as a half-dead cat can be. Sometimes, when Sean comes home from school, he finds the cat dead under the stairs, or in the bathroom, or in the pantry. Other days, he would find her refreshingly alive, purring and rubbing against his legs, and asking for some of her favourite niblets. When she was found dead, she would be put inside her box, where she usually slept. After a while, Sean calculated the cat was alive exactly as much as she was dead, but he could never tell which she would be till he looked inside her box. Sean suspected that tendrils of eccentricity were somehow escaping from the haunted house, that the house was getting stronger and was venturing its weirdness abroad. As mentioned, the Solpierres live in the house right next to the haunted house, and there's been a Solpierre family in Lugano since the town has been in the far south of Switzerland, the very last little bit of Switzerland that sticks its mountainous nose into the flat plain that gives Italy a snorting good start on its journey south. Now, Sean Solpierre, the building up to be hero of our saga, had read in one of his grandfather's even dustier books that Lugano has not always been in Switzerland. In fact, it seems that once upon an almost ridiculously long time ago, it used to be in Italy. He had always wondered how they'd managed to move a whole town from one country to another. If you're interested, the story will eventually, and I do mean rather very eventually, reveal the secret of this little act of municipal grand larceny, and how Sean is not entirely undisconnected to it. Ancient or not, the Solpierre family, as you will find it today, is not really that different to any other family, here or there, which means it is in every way unique. The father of Sean Solpierre is a banker. Now, a good image but poor definition of banker is someone who sits like a fisherman, watching the flow of life pass in front of him, ready to snatch with hooks the bits that appeal to him, not caring particularly where they come from or where otherwise they may be heading. Put more than simply, he knows very little about how the universe works, and so is in the perfect position to proclaim that he knows everything there is to know, at least as far as he knows. The father of Sean had his name abbreviated to Nonno, which is Italian for grandfather, somewhere back in an historical era called the Mists of Time. Inspired by his handy Jurassic timeline foldout, Sean guessed that mists, being plural, must be an era divided into periods, which should, by convention, be called proto-mist, mesomist, and paleomist of time. Despite this theory, Nonno continually referred to one of the mists of time periods as in his day, when he had been some sort of university professor. When he had finally turned 12, Sean received a card attesting that he was now officially of age. It says so clearly. You are now 12 years of age, which seemed to him to be a declaration of manhood of sorts. He decided that his first and foremost duty as a new adult would be to cease to ask irritating questions about why we say things that don't make any sense. This being, by overwhelming evidence, the baseline attitude that distinguishes an adult from a child. Mind you, by this definition, this would make Nonno Solpierre the oldest living child, because he had never criticized Sean for the way he spoke, as Pappy always did. This and a corroborative line of reasoning eventually led Sean to deduce that one of the two must be an imposter Solpierre. The same family could not possibly contain two members who were so determinedly not undisalike as Pappy and Nonno. He decided that the only fair thing to do, genetically speaking, was wait till he knew which of the two he himself was growing into, before deciding which of them was the imposter Solpierre, and call the newspapers and the police for dramatic emphasis, and make a denouement. He gathered he would then be required to give TV interviews, and something he had heard called retaining book and film rights, which is apparently what you do after making headline-grabbing denouement to the police. Nono had only one defining characteristic. He loved knowledge above all else. What made the old professor eccentric, according to Pappy, was that Nono was constantly proclaiming that he knew nothing, and how delightful that was. Whenever Sean came home from school, he would go straight to his grandfather, who was always a fiddling and a rummaging yo-ho-ho in his doing science room at the top of the house. It was full of books which told you what Nono always said about how we know nothing and how delightful that was. Pappy called them those mouldy science books and wanted to bring in useful books on economy and how to make a fortune manuals. But when Nono said to Pappy that you couldn't make a fortune, only take it from someone else, Pappy answered that it didn't matter. A fortune wouldn't have been put there if it wasn't meant for someone to make it, and that is all you need to know. For the same 12th birthday, Sean had received a digital watch. Nono never asked questions like, how much did it cost, like Pappy always did. Nono always said things like he did that day in his doing science room. Want to know how it works? Sure thing, enthused Sean, and he pulled his usual stool up to the workbench. It'll only take a jiffy, said Nono, as he prepared his instruments and a large magnifying lens for the surgical procedure on the device. Sean had worked out, through 100 experiences, that a Nono jiffy was not the same unit as a Pappy jiffy. Pappy's jiffy worked by some sort of mental meter, calculated on the basis of an exchange rate between time and money, so it was definitely some sort of unit less than 10 seconds. At least when it was for something that involved Sean, that is something that couldn't be invoiced. Sean gathered this meant he was outvoiced by something, but by what he had never understood. Perhaps it was out of fear of being outvoiced that he always found himself speaking loudly to Pappy, like he would to anyone who is habitually deaf. By contrast, a Nono jiffy was a time elastic unit, which could be anything from 10 minutes to several weeks. It all depended on how interesting the matter that would only take a jiffy was. Sean laid his digital watch with its cheap plastic strap on Nono's workbench. Ah, what a beauty it is! The old man picked it up reverently and read the inscription on the back plate through the magnifying lens, which made his nose even bigger, if that were possible. Made in China by the Sang Company. What do those other letters mean? Asked Sean. Let me see, Re and Al. That just means that Sang is a trademark registered in all the world. It has lots of apps, boasted Sean. It shows the orbits of the planets around the sun, and it has a calculator and a solar panel to recharge its batteries. Yes, equally enthused Nono. He lifted off the backplate. Here we are. Add to them this piezoelectric crystal timer, the silicon chip, not to forget the synthetic material of the strap, and I would say you have here a fine collection of technologies. It's not a good watch. Pappy says there are lots more in the shops that are much more expensive, shrugged Sean modestly, but nevertheless pleased with the accolades. Nono tut-tutted through his few natural teeth. It is exactly that makes this so wonderful. We've only just started, and yet we have already found no less than 6 miracles of science in this little beauty. Opening this is like a journey through time, in both senses. Nono's explanations always did a round-robin circuit of science, history, philosophy, then back to science, always back to science, as if it were that that drove the mechanism of time, and not the other way round. And philosophy? Well, that just went along for the ride. Now, any one of these would have caused a revolution should they have appeared in any other period of history, just as any future technology would change our world suddenly and dramatically if it appeared here. Technology jumping back in time? That isn't possible, Nono. Nono glanced at Sean over the rims of his spectacles. That's your father speaking. When we don't know something, those who need to think they know everything invent an explanation, and then try to force the universe to fit it. They abbreviate imprecise possibility to impossibility. The correct answer is, We just don't know, and isn't that fun? Finished Sean for him, clapping his hands happily.
Precisely. Something I've observed is that knowledge packets are skitty things. As far as we know, any number of them may have jumped any number of times through history. We would never know, because when it happened, everybody would immediately start living with the new technology that comes from it, and assume it is all part of some natural state of affairs. So who knows?
I sure don't, said Sean proudly.
Always remember, those who think they know the least actually know the most. There is no greater fear than the unknown, and no greater unknown than the nature of the forces that keep the universe ticking. If nobody knows what rotates it, the High Priest of Know-It-All can put any spin he likes on it.
Sean giggled. He loved having the world's most eccentric grandfather. But Nonno, why would a watch change history?
Well, what can you do with a watch?
Only tell the time.
There is nothing only about it. To most people, for most of history, that ability would have been a source of great wonder. And because people's minds work in a most peculiar way, wonder usually converts readily to power and wealth. Just ask your father. Now, if you are the only one who can, simply the ability to measure time precisely and consistently, in the dark, in any season and any weather, on the left or right-hand side of the street, to be the only one who knows he is late for a meeting, would have been a source of great power in the past.
I don't see why. Sean crinkled up his brow like he had seen smart people do on television. What advantage was there in knowing you were late for a meeting?
Nonno clipped the backplate back on. Did you know that Napoleon won the Battle of Austerlitz in 1805 because Austria's allies, the Russians, were 12 days late? And you know why? Because they were using the wrong calendar.
You're saying they were late for the battle and didn't know it?
That's why they were called the Russians. Like any good comedian, Napoleon was a master of timing. I wonder what his secret was.
Nonno cleaned the watch on a soft cloth, saying in his quiet, mystery-coming-up voice, "But most importantly of all, with this," he waved the watch, "you can extend mathematics, the language of the gods, into the fifth realm of the ordinary."
"What is that?"
Nonno put the watch back on Sean's wrist and patted it gently. "That is where the secret of time lies hidden."
Sean looked with a new awe at the instrument, which had been elevated in ranking so quickly from Pappy's "nasty cheap foreign import" to Nonno's "marvel of our age."
"So how do we get to this fifth realm?"
"Trying to answer that very question, young Sean, is what cost me my job at the university."
"Oh, Nonno."
"I'm not sorry at all. Something in the meantime has made me very glad it happened."
"What?"
"Let us just say it has given me the opportunity to find out how to understand the strangest truth of all."
"And what is that, Nonno?"
"That there is no time."
Sean let this one ride over him for a few, apparently non-existent, moments, before coming out with, "Cool by me."
And so that is how it was at the Silpierre home, and much the same every day, until, that is, Sean's mother disappeared. Yes, you heard correctly. One day Sean's mother simply vanished, and then nothing. No ransom demand arrived for Pappy to haggle over, so his strategy ran out of ideas pretty early on in the piece. Nonno made no comment except to ask the TV and newspaper reporters, who ambushed them as they came to or left the house, to kindly go somewhere hot and deep. When I say nothing happened, that is obviously a literary device, more generally known as a lie. Nonno had become totally obsessed with the haunted house from that day on, and Pappy told Sean not to disturb Nonno's own, if peculiar, way of mourning, and unimaginatively attributed it to any one of several old-age ailments that are thrown out at random to explain eccentricities. Sean, for his part, experienced the trauma as any child would. The effect was similar to that on a sheep of an approaching Robbie Burns night. Something deep inside gets ripped out from where it is badly needed. He spent his days longing for her to walk in, as she had always done, trailing behind her the shopping trolley that he had repaired himself with brightly coloured string, and say,
So many people in the shops today. I don't know what the world is coming to. Honestly, I don't.
He missed everything about her, from Sunday morning chocolate cookies to the orders to go to bed and stop being the naughtiest boy under this very sky. Without that acclaim, nothing he did seemed to have any promise of joy, because his naughtiness was now universally understood and tolerated under the circumstances, which is the worst of all conditions for a boy who had once referred to himself as the prince of all naughties. Now he sat long hours at the window, looking for her, hoping that each day would bring some news that would reignite even the faintest of candles at the end of this terrible, lonely tunnel that had become his life. Lonely, that is, if it weren't for Nonno and his totally wacky ideas. Sean once asked Pappy that if that were the case, what could he do to become senile too? Pappy had recently gone from being a reasonably successful financier to achieving what the newspapers called an oracle status. As a result, the cloak of respectability was contemptuously cast aside as he was promoted to the far superior media rank of phenomenally rich, whose bright sun of wealth blotted out all debate and moral dissent. What, I hear you being prompted to ask, had brought about this sudden transformation? Sean suspected it had something to do with the haunted house. For the record, Nonno knew it had. Pappy Serlepierre had gone all secret about 3 months before Mammy disappeared, which, added to the intervening period and subtracting the number you first thought of, makes this the year 2010 and 7/8. All secret involved Pappy doing stuff online, down there. Now, down there is the basement to the Serlepierre house, even though there were far nicer rooms further up the four-story building. And online means he was a blogger. Using an array of computers hooked up to a pasta dinner of cables going in every direction, Pappy operated his Oracle Financial Information Service. People who didn't have enough lifetime left to spend the money they already had were more than desperate to make much, much more by subscribing to this fantastically expensive service, which could unerringly predict future stock market prices. Sean was forbidden to enter this basement sanctum, which suited him just fine.